Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Friday, the 21st of October. A show we didn't expect to exist, but because you're all such good people and the fun drive is over, it does exist. How lovely. Good morning and welcome. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. And let me introduce our panelists to you. First, the most exhausted man in show business, Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe. And when you, if you would, and when we're done with the introductions, I'd love to read just a couple of the letters that have come in about the fund drive. Okay?
Oh, sure. Yeah, excellent. All right. And let me also introduce author and activist and our dear friend, Barbara Smith. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning and congratulations on the fund drive.
Thank you very much for that. And very nice to have you back.
Thank you.
And Chris Churchill, who I contacted late in the evening last night and said, hey, you up for a panel? And he said, sure, I'm up for a panel. So he's here and we couldn't be more delighted. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I know you're probably writing a column and we bothered you, but thank you for taking the call.
That's
very nice of you. All right. So, Alan, yes, before we move on to other stuff, let us begin on a sweet note.
Okay. So Megan writes us and says, happy Friday. I've been listening to WAMC for over 10 years now. I actually love listening to the Fun Drive because we get to hear so many great little candid stories and conversations while supporting good stories. Causes. For all those years, I actually thought I was called the Fun Drive, and it made perfect sense to me because you all seem to be having so much fun. I only realized it was the fund when I began looking closely at the website yesterday. Even my 8-year-old son knew it was the Fun Drive. Ha! Anyway, we love you, and we love our station. That was nice. We heard from Naomi and Kane and Ray and Allen or Who together. And if I could afford it, I would pledge over and over again while listening to WMC's Fun Drive early morning sessions. As funny as their tag team humor is, I'm so very glad to have my wonderful round table back. And that's Naomi. Isn't that nice?
Very nice.
Okay, so there's just two we've got.
All right. Well, let's...
That's it. That's it for now.
Okay. That's it for now. More may be coming. All right.
Oh, they will.
Yeah. So we want to start off with what's going on, and obviously we talked yesterday about the debate, and the repercussions of that are continuing, of course, as we would, I think, we would expect them to come. So yesterday, the big story that came out of the debate on Wednesday was Donald Trump saying that we'll keep you in suspense about those election results. You know, whether I decide if I'm going to accept them or not, I'll let you know when I figure it out. So then yesterday the line was, I will accept the results of this great election process, ... if I win. All right, so that was the line yesterday, with a tiny bit of clarification that if we see any irregularities, if we see anything concerning, if we see anything that we find to be, you know, of concern, which of course leads wide open as to what that could be. So there was that. And then last night, the candidates faced each other once again at the Alfred Smith Dinner in New York City at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And both candidates spoke, both candidates. And that's a rather a lighthearted event where people come and they say a barb or two. And it's not supposed to be like a Friars Club roast, but, you know, a little fun. And a light moment to help a great cause, and of course from Catholic Charities and helping children and raising a lot of money. And so last night Donald Trump got up. He had a couple great jokes, and then he had a couple just brutal. I don't even want to call them zingers. They were just brutal
attacks. That's what they were.
Attacks, and he got booed. And for most people, they say it was the first time they ever heard anybody get booed at the Alfred Smith dinner. Now, it could be argued, of course, that in New York City, that this is Hillary's crowd. But by the same token, never had they ever seen anyone get booed. Hillary also had some incredibly good barbs, and we may even say on an occasion or two, an attack. But she was far more self-deprecating in the setup to those jokes than he was. So that is kind of where we are now, and I'll let whoever wants to chime in. Alan, do you want to start off?
Well, there's not much to say except it showed him to be a bully again. He obviously had a script that he was supposed to follow that they gave him with a bunch of jokes in the beginning, and he did well in the beginning. And as soon as he went off script and he started to call her Crooked Hillary and to do all that stuff. And people really didn't like it.
Yeah, I don't think that was off script, though.
Expected.
I don't think that was off script.
Oh, I think it was off Donald's script. I think that they had given him self-deprecating jokes. He did them in the beginning, and they were warmly received. But it was only when he really got rabid, and then he had Rudy Giuliani sitting in the audience, glowering at Hillary. Look, this guy, in order to win, needs a Hail Mary pass of the first order. And he's looking for it. And he thinks that the way he won the Republican primaries, which was being Donald, is going to work for the larger audience. And he's just wrong. I defer to my erstwhile colleagues who know far more than I do. How's that for
self-deprecation? Erstwhile, that means in the past. That doesn't mean not in the room, but means in the past. Well, anyway, erstwhile.
Erstwhile number one will go at... I don't know. I didn't see the entire dinner last night, but I did see some of the highlights, and that joke about Hillary hates Catholics was the one that was just like, whoa, that was
the cardinal didn't like that one.
No, the cardinal didn't like that
Everybody looked shocked. Every face in the background was like, you know.
Well, when he started off on that path and said Crooked Hillary, you could see the mouths drop open, and then it just sort of got darker. And yeah, even at that point with the joke about the Catholics, I believe the cardinal just sort of reached over and put his hand on Hillary. I mean, it was obviously uncomfortable for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that dinner is probably going to be awkward a little bit anyways. I mean, especially going 2 days after the debate. Day after the debate. But I remember in years past, it kind of being like almost like a break from the campaign, kind of a moment of civility amidst the craziness.
And they say that most of the people who attend are Republicans. That's what they were saying as they were covering it, following it last night. I found that interesting.
I don't know. I thought it was a mixed crowd. I mean, she certainly had the room, I think, at several points, but I don't know.
Well, the point that they were making is that given the number of Republicans who generally attend this or who are actually there, that they did not buy what he was doing either, that they found it very offensive.
Yeah. He did have some funny bits. I mean, the bit about Melania's speech was really funny.
I missed that one.
Very good.
Unfortunately, I just had come in.
But that was self-deprecation, so that always goes over well. People, you know, it's when you're attacking somebody who's 2 feet away from you that it gets awkward.
Right. So for Barbara, who said she didn't hear it, why don't you tell everybody what it was, Chris, what the joke was?
Well... I'm not going to be able to tell it as well as Donald did, but it was something along the lines of media bias is obvious. If you want proof of it, look at the way
Michelle Obama.
Yeah, the media loved Michelle Obama's speech and said how wonderful it was, and then Melania gave the exact same speech and they panned it.
Yeah, so. It was good.
Good line.
But it does seem, I mean, not to read too much into this. And by the way, out of all of what we've been through in the past year and a half, the Al Smith dinner is not going to be the clincher in this election, right?
I mean,
no.
of little or no import, except that it does show the fractious nature of the campaign, and especially when you compare it to 4 and 8 years ago when the candidates were really funny and were and had gentle barbs at each other, and
right.
and even Romney and President Obama really had some and it was lighthearted, and they seemed to enjoy each other.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly was not the case last night.
No, I mean, yeah, some of Hillary's jokes had a really harsh edge too.
I was going to say yeah. that unlike Donald Trump, those other candidates who you mentioned, they actually had some good home training. And it's obvious, as rich as he was, a spoiled little rich boy as he was, he has no home training. None. Zero.
Well, there was...
What do you mean, Barbara? What do you mean by home
training?
Well,
when
training?
We say home training...
He wasn't raised well.
He wasn't brought up
yes,
to be a good
yes,
boy.
And it yeah. is a black term within the black, you know, community.
Oh, is
when
that
we
right?
talk about yeah. people having good home training, we take pride in it, you know? We say, well, she obviously or he obviously has good home training. Or you say... Obviously, that person has no home training.
My mother would have said,
"Oh, that's great.
Know your manners."
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I heard home training, the only thing I could think of was toilet training.
I know.
And so,
well, that's part of it.
I thought you were going there.
That
yeah,
is part
that
of it.
Just, that's the first. Yeah. That may be the first step. No.
We didn't see the day after.
Can you take the children out somewhere and they don't humiliate you for, you know, all, you know, eternity? That's
yeah.
You know, it's like knowing how to interact with people and having civility and being, you know, polite and just knowing how you act.
Okay, but the bigger news that came out of yesterday was Donald Trump insisting, doubling down a phrase I hope goes away with the election cycle, insisted that he would not cede the right to contest the outcome of the election, even as members of both parties said such remarks were a threat to the political system. But he also tried to ease concerns, saying he would abide by all the rules and traditions. Was that enough?
I don't know.
Well, no.
Yeah.
I don't think it was enough because, you know, this is not kidding around stuff. This is a guy who is going to have his hand on the button, on the nuclear button, on the bombs. And so if he kids around about that, if he kids around about it, it's not a place to kid around. And if you say, I may lead my 34% or whatever else into some kind of rebellion, he doesn't say those words, but it's implied that if he doesn't, that there will be very angry people and that he'll lead them in a particular way and that the country's reputation for a peaceful transference of power will be ended. You know, I don't think it's funny stuff.
Well, it all depends on how the election turns out, though, right? I mean, if the election's not close, then none of this is going to matter. You know, I mean.
Well, what if the election is close, though, Chris? That's the point. What if the election is close? And then he starts, you know, doing. And I think that the election may be close. So if that's the case, what happens then? If he gives signals that we should not accept the results of the election. Look, Gore versus Bush, nothing could have been closer.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Gore did the right thing. And I ain't a Gore fan, that is for sure. And I use the word ain't. Don't be writing me letters, folks, to give emphasis to the whole thing.
There's a point that I haven't heard anybody else make about the aftermath of the election and why his statements are so dangerous, and that's the level of vitriol and the level of anger and violence
yeah.
that he is inspiring in his followers and his true believers. After the 2008 election of the first African American, there was a rise in hate crimes, there were murders, there was a church burning in Springfield, Massachusetts. There were crimes that happened. Some of them were on the level of like, you know, mischief or whatever they call those lower level crimes. But there are some people who died as a result. And that's what my greatest fear is, because in that case, there was one group that might potentially be targeted based upon the dynamics of the campaign. In this case, it's a whole list of people. And I've read some articles. I actually, you know, kind of researched this because I remember these incidents happening. But as I said, nobody else seems to be concerned about what an aftermath would look like in relationship to that kind of hate violence. But one of the things that these articles that I found said that much like the aftermath of September 11th, there were attacks on people who were Muslim or who were assumed to be Muslim. But the thing that's so ironic here is that now we have a situation where Muslims, people of color, women, all kinds of people, Mexicans, Latinos, Latinas, all kinds of people are going to be in the crosshairs of people who are going to be extremely aggrieved, particularly when their leader says that the election is illegitimate.
I think it's a brilliant analysis, Barbara, really. And it is further exacerbated by the fact that there are some people, we know this, we've seen it in the past, who believe this stuff in a way that it may not have even been intended, and who then turn around and, because they're mentally disturbed or something else, go ahead and start to kill people. We've seen it, we know it, and it is something, and we've seen it across the board. It is really something that is scary.
The question that's been brought up, though, and I heard a discussion somewhere just this morning, where they were talking about this in many respects as to his following, and if Donald Trump loses the election, and of those, whatever the number is, 30-40%, of that following, where do they go next? And the point made, well, where does Donald go? So is he going to be like, he's not going to be barnstorming Iowa and Kansas and going in through the Midwest anymore. That travel is going to stop, isn't it? And unless he has a voice through what Trump TV or whatever the case may be, that's going to be about the extent of it, and it's going to reduce fairly quickly, don't you think?
There was a poll out, and I'm going to get the numbers a little bit wrong, but it was a Bloomberg poll, and the question was something like, if Donald Trump loses, what will you do next? And I think it was 26% said they'll stay loyal to Donald Trump, that, you know, they'll remain loyal to him, and he'll still be kind of the leader of the party.
I'm so sorry.
I don't know if that really happens, though. I mean, his whole thing, his whole persona is so much about winning and so much about crushing the opponent and being the macho man, that if he really gets humiliated, and that seems possible, I wonder if how much of that aura around him stays, or if he just kind of is remembered as a guy who kind of really got embarrassed.
The other thing, too, we're going to have to take a break, but I just want to read this. That same poll, which I actually had bookmarked here, that if Clinton wins, which of the following do you want to be the face of the Republican Party nationally? 27% said Mike Pence, 24% said Donald Trump, and 19% said Ted Cruz. Paul Ryan had 15%. We're going to take a break. We'll be back and continue our conversation after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, Chris Churchill make up the panel. It's a delight to have you all with us this morning. We do have a couple of letters, several letters actually, on the Alfred Smith dinner, and then we will go back to our conversation as to other elements of the campaign. And I also would like to, because there's a couple, there's some other things to talk about in regards to the campaign, and one of those, of course, is continuing angst of the GOP, which will probably be a story, but I would like to address that. So let's go to some of those letters, Alan, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the race itself.
We're actually getting quite a few letters. We have one from Bobby, who says, at the fundraiser, you cited Trump as good example of self-deprecating was his with his joke about his wife plagiarizing Michelle Obama's speech. That was publicly deprecating his wife, not himself. Shameful. And we've got a couple of
that is actually true. It wasn't self-deprecation. It was
He threw her under the bus, and although he then also, which I noticed has not been in any of the clips that they've replayed, but he also did say she didn't do anything wrong, the person responsible for that is Wong, and then he asked his wife to stand up and mm-hmm. take a bow. So it was a little mm-hmm. more polished mm-hmm. than that, but yes, go ahead.
Michael says, I see Trump bringing some parts of both parties together with their disgust of this candidate. Could he possibly be a uniting force for our republic? Says Michael. Okay. And let's see. Melissa says, Firstly, congratulations on the amazing fun drive. I listen to Alan and Ray every morning. I am a sarcastic, dark human person, so it was a great way to start my morning. Love you guys. I just wanted to add that photo of Trump and Hillary on the website. Looks like he is grabbing her behind. Memes to follow. Have a lovely day. Melissa. Okay. Andy says, good morning, Roundtable. The Electoral College tally for the election and will not be close. Our country has always had a dark side. That said, we always manage to get through the darkness. There have been other examples of demagogues like Father Coughlin and George Wallace, and Trump will be an interesting yet dark footnote in American history. The big question is how we raise all boats. If we can manage that, then what Trump represents will go away.
Excuse me, Alan. I have to say, yeah, I totally disagree that he will be a footnote. Father Coughlin was a radio person. Even though he fanned the flames of hatred and bigotry with a wide audience, with a wide platform, he was not running for elected office, nor did he hold elected office. Now, George Wallace is a more parallel example because he was governor of a state, Alabama, namely. And he had power when he was term limited. His wife ran for governor, and essentially he got that many terms. I don't remember how many terms she served. But as I said, to say that Trump and what he has done is a footnote, from my vantage point, I don't see it that way at all.
And George Wallace ran for president a couple times, and he never got anywhere near this far. You know,
Yes, he did.
But historically, I want to point out, because none of us were really there at the time, I was closest, and that was that Father Coughlin was considered a very dangerous person. And he had millions of Americans on his side. And he was anti-Semitic, and he was anti-black, and he was, you name it, he was doing all of that stuff. So you really can't sort of just say he was a footnote. The footnote I was thinking of is, and not a footnote at all, was Hitler. You know, because Hitler lost elections. Hitler was a guy who involved himself in a putsch before and a putsch afterwards, and then finally won. But, you know, I see very disturbing similarities here, and I'll get letters on it, and I don't care.
Part of the thing with everyone's talking about Trump, what happens next, I mean, first of all, we don't know what this election's going to entail, so maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. But he's not a young man. I mean, he's 69 or 70, and
he's 70
years old.
He's probably very unlikely he has another presidential run in him. And his, no matter what, his time on the stage is not going. He doesn't have, you know, three more decades ahead of him like a younger candidate might.
Mm. Also, there is that idea though about what his role is post-election. But if Hillary Clinton wins, I mean, she's really she's the one who has to start to bring everybody together and work very hard. And I think you see it very slowly, even starting now at this point in the campaign. It's tough, obviously, when there is so much acrimony between the two. But I mean, she obviously is going to be the one with a real job on her hands to try to pick up some of the pieces and get something done, but also to bring people together and much to Alan's point of, you know, saying something that, you know, is going to upset people, but quite frankly, she's going to have to get people to like her.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge because that feeling about her is so entrenched.
Well, when you have a percentage of the population that thinks that she should be in jail and not the White House, I mean, how do you smooth that over? I don't know how you do
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. It's off sometimes a family, the first family that makes the president more likable. Bill?
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
You know, unless you can get those grandchildren to live in the White House,
I just don't see it. Get a couple of cute puppies, maybe.
Yeah, get them to grow up quick.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, they can come in as babies. Yeah. You know, get the whole family living in the White House. And
do like a little John kind of thing.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. You know.
Got it.
You know, but the earlier letter writer wrote something that was extraordinarily prescient, I thought, and that was America has always had a dark side. That there is always, look, we lived through a civil war as a country. We know what came next. It was terrible. And that group of people who were there, and it's remained amazingly constant during this whole election. Hillary's pulling away, but she's pulling away with independents. Sure, there are a few people who have gotten out of the Trump camp, but not that many. And all it's going to take is a couple of really bad people doing really bad things. I think Hillary will be. I'm worried about Hillary, but for another reason. I don't want Hillary to make mistakes. I don't want her to make mistakes. I think she's made some mistakes during this and before the campaign. I still think she shouldn't have taken the money. I don't. Everybody else does it. Right. But she knew she was going to run for president. I don't think it was the right thing to do, not because it was illegal, but because it just wasn't smart in terms of what America was thinking about bankers at the time. I am concerned that I'm going to vote for her, but I'm concerned that she's going to screw it up, and that she and Bill will do things that will not redound to their popularity.
Well, that would be the flip side of a landslide victory, right? I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, it would repudiate Trump, but on the other hand, it might kind of embolden the Clintons to do things that maybe they shouldn't do. You know, when people win big, they get arrogant and they think that they have.
Well, one of the things that these WikiLeaks,
I agree.
One of the things that we've seen in these is that it's a campaign and it's a setup that is complete, you know, and I would argue for somewhat good reason that for whatever you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I think she even said that in one of the emails. But they're so concerned, I mean, even about pneumonia, you know, that there has to be these strategy sessions on how to discuss that the woman is ill, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. And it comes off as a scandal when you could just put out a press release and say, oh, by the way, I have a cold and I'm going to stay home. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Alan completely. You know, you do wonder about the mistakes and the mindset that allows that to be secretive and to be overly guarded, and also to your point too, Chris, of to be emboldened that you have a mandate and then go forward with that mentality.
Yeah,
I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. As Freud said, character is formed by the time you're four or five. And if you take a look at their history, at the Clinton history, that's where they have to watch out, you know, for being arrogant and for making mistakes. Chris, I'm sorry, I stepped
up. No, that's okay. I was going to make the same point. I mean, I was going to mention the Clinton history, and that skirting of the line is always kind of is always there, you know. And I think what you were saying about the speeches is accurate. I mean, she didn't need to do them. Why do it?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and we'll move on to a couple of other things. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, Chris Churchill, I'm Joe Donahue. We'll be back after this break.
Support for WAMC comes from H. House & Son True Value Hardware and Just Ask Rentals Woodstock, locally owned since 1932, featuring Benjamin Moore paints, tools, and materials for home maintenance. Behind every project is a true value. HHoused.com. Capital Car Share, a car sharing network offering a fleet of eco-friendly vehicles for neighborhood transportation. 24-hour reservations available online. CapitalCarShare.org for donations and information. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony. Locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel and to our discussion this morning. Again, Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, and Chris Churchill. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org. Alan, let's go to some letters.
Okay. Rick says, I hate to say this, guys. I do. I apologize for it. Rick says, Trump, Hitler, Alan is right again. Trump is using Hitlerian tactics, particularly the big lie, Rick in Needham, Massachusetts. All right. And Tracy says, good morning, roundtable. I have to admit that I'm a little frightened. For Hillary after seeing the man at Trump's rally earlier in the week saying if she got into the White House, he would have to do his duty as a patriot and make sure she didn't serve. When pressed as to what he meant, he said, take it any way you want. I'm a patriot. I hope he's enjoying his time with the Secret Service. And that's from Tracy. Yeah, you know, I think the Secret Service has done a good job, but there's only so much you can do with Obama. I am so pleased that Obama has not had to suffer any of this stuff, really.
What do you mean by that?
It's extraordinary.
What do you mean?
In other words, he's alive. That's what I mean. And I mean, there are plenty of crazy people out there. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that he's still alive is... And the fears we all had for him have not been realized. It's just great that they've done their job. Did you want to check in on that, Barbara?
Yeah, when you said that he hasn't had to suffer any of this, I did not exactly know that you're... So I guess there's such a thing as a failed assassination attempt. But, you know, it's kind of all or nothing, if you see what I'm saying.
That, mm-hmm.
It was just like describing it as suffer any of this as opposed to be in extreme danger.
Well,
that may be my words. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
That language ahead, that, you, that the letter writer cited, I mean, that's not hard to find. You can find that on Facebook. It could take you about 10 minutes.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's out there for sure.
Well, on both sides, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And that's really, that's not acceptable.
And that's, you know, that's kind of why that dinner last night was a little bit of an opportunity lost, right? Because in years past, it was kind of a time to kind of cool down everything a little bit. And obviously, this election's a lot hotter than the previous ones were anyways. But, you know, it could have been kind of a nice moment, and it didn't turn out that way.
Cardinal Dolan was on the Today Show today, and I think to your point of the years past, you know, we're not talking about like the 30s or 40s either. 4 years ago,
right?
it was much more refined than it was last night.
Well, 4 years ago, you
well, what did the cardinal what did the cardinal people. Say, Joe?
I mean, he was putting a good spin on it that he had gotten them to shake hands and to understand. He did say that, much to Chris's point, that he felt that there had always been a large sense of self-deprecation, and that we are now in a cycle of going after the other person, and he felt that was a misread of the room on both candidates' parts and a misread of the event. But he did feel that overall there was an understanding by the end of you know, they had accomplished what they wanted to accomplish. He was putting a good face on it for the event. But was also saying that, you know, there were times where they were very civil to one another when they were just sitting next to each other. So, you know, it's an interesting thing to look at. But I think, you know, I don't think it surprises any of us that these are two people who don't like each other. So
Brian wrote in, dear Roundtable, the Clintons feel their speeches have significant value. I disagreed with Bill Clinton coming to UAlbany for a paid speech. A few semesters later, the school cut 5 educational departments to save its budget. And that's from Brian. Maureen says, Trump was definitely reading from a script at that dinner. The man must have been surrounded by yes men. I would love to get him to sit down with me and some of my nasty women friends to discuss the facts. Congrats on the fund drives. And you know, that's interesting because the unlikely stuff that happens. I mean, when he said she's a nasty woman, what did he intend to prove? Instead, it's really turned around and bit him in the hiney. I mean, all over the country, people are putting nasty T-shirts on and putting them on the making money from them and putting them on the web. And, you know, these things have repercussions. And I doubt that he had thought that one through.
Yeah, that seemed to be just kind of a quick aside. But to be honest, it kind of surprises me that one has taken off as much as it has. I mean, in the previous debate, he called her the devil. He said she has hate in her soul. A nasty woman, by contrast, doesn't seem that that significant.
But I think women look at it. There was a great story last night on All Things Considered about the history of the word nasty, and that that women look at this almost as a badge of honor in some cases of to be nasty, and looking at it as a sense of pride, and I think that was something that they felt he misread in that, and also it was something that they could turn to say, look, I'm nasty, I'm going to vote against you.
Mm-hmm. And Janet Jackson, let's not forget her, because
yeah, they played that song too.
Nasty
was already in the parlance.
Yeah. Well, it went so what'd they say? The downloads went up 200% as a result.
Right,
so,
yeah. I didn't know it existed.
Which I'm sure was only radio producers. But
until
anyway,
they started playing it, I said, there's a song called that?
Go ahead, Alan.
I just wanted to say one thing. I'm very slow, and as you point out, I'm very tired. But when you said I was the... You know, I was the most exhausted man. You got to be right up there too, Joe, because your stints on the radio, the morning and the afternoon, were incredible, just incredible.
Well,
you know, it takes me some time to be a gentleman, but there you are.
Well, thank you. I don't
want to be nasty.
I will say that I took a brief nap yesterday. That felt very, very good, and then got a good night's sleep last night, even though I was watching the Cubs win.
So,
which was exciting.
The Cubs won.
So now it's what, 3?
So now it's 2-2.
2-2, isn't it?
2-2. 2-2.
So as a person who grew up in Cleveland, I was thinking about the World Series.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, look, Cleveland is in the World Series, but wouldn't it be great to see Cleveland and the Cubs in the World
Series? Yeah, that's just going to be... That's like planets flying backwards. That's just so
incredible. Yeah, that
shouldn't
be what it is.
Maybe neither one of them will win, though. You ever think of that?
That's so wrong.
Good point.
Anyway, Steve from Narrowsburg writes, hello, group.
Hello.
Don't forget that although Hillary is clearly no saint, that the most virulent criticism of her liar, rigged, Benghazi, Paula Jones, etc., comes from the same discredited sources as Donald's dubious claims about himself, and that's from Stephen Narrowsburg. And I think Narrowsburg is an important part of our listening area because it is where I went to Boy Scout camp.
Well, then, yes, it is.
10 Mile River, hats off to thee, and to thy colors true we will ever be. What do you think about that? That's, you know, a long time ago.
It is. Well, I don't know. How long ago was that?
I'm now 75, and then I was 12.
Okay.
So 12 from 75, like 63 years ago.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And we all remember the traumatic things that happened. The swimming, which you didn't want to do, and the fact that your father came for your birthday and brought ice cream for everybody in the bunk, and there was one short.
And you didn't
and
get
guess
any.
Who didn't get one?
You. You.
All right. Let's go. Nasty by Janet.
Glad you're not
Judy.
Bitter.
It's only 63.
Yeah,
years
yeah.
Ago.
You're not bitter. That's good.
disappointed. Nasty by Janet. She is referring to nasty boys in the song for your information.
All right.
And Theron says, Cubs today. Oh, it's up 3-2.
Yeah, 3-2.
3-2.
3-2. They need to win one. They need to win one more.
Okay.
At best of seven.
They must win one more.
And they move back to Chicago and it's Saturday night, right? Yeah.
Just shows that everything is possible. And that the Cubbies do that would be fantastic. I'm sorry, Barbara, but Cleveland just doesn't rank when it compares to this.
I don't want to get into it, Alan. Not getting into it.
I don't know. I have to say, I'm a Cubs fan, but I do. This one's tough for me because no matter who wins, unlike the presidential election, no matter who wins the World Series, I feel good.
Right,
I feel really
from,
good for that.
You're
city.
Not from either one
I
of those places.
I am not from either of those places.
Cleveland right. did just get the basketball title, so, you know, they don't have to get greedy about it.
Basketball, exactly. Basketball.
All right. Go ahead, Alan. We got a few more minutes before we take a break.
Okay, Diane says, yes, she's made mistakes. That's Hillary. She is secretive, and he can't control his personality. Let's move on. We want her to be president because she's got the experience and credentials we need. Let's urge her to give more attention to climate change. And that's from Diane. All right. And then, oh, boy, a few election comments from Fred. The habit of secrecy could be a result of paranoia, but it is not paranoia when they have been trying to get you for decades. Exactly. Being paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. I can relate to that.
Yeah, but
I'm always want. I've yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm just. You know, that goes back to her. I mean, that goes back to what Attorney General in Arkansas, right? I mean, it's been sort of that way for a really, really long time.
And when you're covering up the fact that you've got pneumonia, you're probably taking it too far. The secrecy. I mean, you know, there's paranoia, and then it's just it's.
Well, we do have to take into account that her opponent has belittled her fitness, her physical fitness and her health.
No, that's true.
So I think that might have been in their calculations.
And we did get a letter about damned if you do and damned if you don't of saying that you've got a cold, and they would say that, you know, she's not fit and she's I think more to the point is the way it was handled. And I mean, Alan was talked very strongly about this when it happened. But why are you ducking the press at the 9/11 event? Why are you not telling people where you're going? Why are you not, you know, making it clear at that point instead of, because it just looks bad. It's just like, how do you make such a silly mistake?
The worst part of her campaign this whole is when she came out of that apartment building and said it's a beautiful day in New York after everyone had all just seen her collapsing into a car.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, it's kind of like, come on.
The Obamas, I think, have been really good at having a private life, and I don't know if anybody would describe them as secretive. I wouldn't, but I think, you know, there's a balance that clearly the Clintons go and weigh it in the other direction.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, you know, I still think a lot of these mistakes can be attributed to overprotective staff who are competing with each other for protecting her and come up with all of these mishugana ideas about why transparency is bad, why you shouldn't do it. We have to do that. We see it in the WikiLeaks. We see it in other places. You know, you really got to think for yourself, and the presidential candidate or the president has to set the tone with the staff. You don't run me, I run you.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely. And that it comes from the top. And sometimes when the person, and I don't know that it's in this case, but sometimes when the person is overly open and gregarious, that's when the staff is sort of overly eager to protect them from outside forces. And I don't know whether that's the case here or not.
But I don't think she is innately gregarious and open.
No, it doesn't
really
seem to be.
I think it has a lot to do with her family background, her character, her personality, and also the fact that she's a woman.
Did you say her home life?
No, I did not. I said her character, her personality.
I know, but that would be part of it, right?
Right, yeah. I'm thinking about that very, very, kind of punitive father, not punitive physically.
Home
but,
training.
Yeah,
that
withholding. Emotionally withholding.
Home training.
You never do good, well enough. He had a brilliant daughter, and it doesn't seem like he absolutely reinforced that. But it also has to do with her era. You know, the era. She and I grew up in the same era.
Right.
And the thing is that a tendency to want to try to protect yourself in a male world, you know, and I see that.
Mm. We're going to take a break. We're going to take a break.
Okay.
We'll be right
sure.
back right
sure.
after this. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. You know, it's a lot of fun doing the fun drive, but it's very nice to be back home in the studio doing the show, and we thank you very much for allowing us to do that. So we have a lot to talk about, and I wanted to get to this story because I came across it last night, and I thought it was really interesting, and that is, as soon as I find it, I will I will read it. I promise.
Meantime, we'll vamp till ready.
Yes,
we'll vamp
please,
until
please
ready,
do. I just realized that for some reason my that story that I wanted to talk about that I thought I just had to press the button is actually the link is broken. So,
there's nothing worse than a broken link. Ooh.
I know. What do you do then, Alan? What do you do?
Yeah, and you know, we keep telling people not to send us links. Doesn't matter. Every day they send us
links.
Well,
that's true. Well, this is one I send, but I sent it, I believe, incorrectly. But, okay, there we go.
Well, just... Okay.
So the point is, there was there's a controversy brewing in Norman, Oklahoma. The lecture at the Norman, Oklahoma High School was intended to heal the racial divides, a student said. The discussion's premise, white people are racist, all of them. Following the discussion, an Oklahoma teacher is under fire and a high school is mired in the debate about how teachers should inject themselves into controversial conversations about race in the United States. This has been reported. NBC affiliate KFOR reported on the controversy last week after receiving a recording from an offended student at Norman North High School. In the recording, the teacher shows a YouTube clip about imperialism. A man in the video uses white out on a globe to illustrate how European influence spread across the world. The discussion follows. In the recording, the teacher asks, am I a racist? And I say, yeah, I don't want to be. It's not like I choose to be a racist, but do I do things because of the way I was raised? To be white is to be racist, period, said the teacher. The offended student told the NBC affiliate in an interview that she felt picked on because she is white. The station didn't name the student or the teacher. And again, this brings up this question about many students are supporting the teacher. They walked out of high school in protest. Student organizers released a statement that the school district shared with media outlets. The girl's father said, why is it okay to demonize one race to children that you were supposed to be teaching a curriculum to? Barbara?
Okay. There's so much to say about this story, and it may be a challenge to explain my perspective on the matter, and a perspective that's shared by many who look at these issues of race on a serious, often academic, research-based level. But I'm going to try. One thing to think about, I'm interested in the response of this student who said she felt like she was being picked on, and then her father asking, why would you demonize one race over another? When we talk about race in the United States, racism, white supremacy, etc., it's really important to the degree that it is possible to, on some level, remove ourselves from it personally and individually, because if that's the road we go down, it's almost impossible to have a rational and useful discussion. When we think about race, it's like, am I culpable? Am I responsible? Is it my fault? Are you better than me? Blah, 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 blah. That can really be kind of a dead end, because we don't really then look at the systems, the institutional manifestations that are kind of above our head and above our ability to control. Having said all of that, and I don't know if I've made any sense yet, but having said all of that, there are people talk about, when we talk about racism, one of the definitions of racism is privilege plus power.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that you have an identity that is privileged in the nation, and then you also have the power to impose sanctions and negative outcomes upon people who do not have that privileged identity. If you don't like a certain group of people and cannot change their life outcomes based upon your dislike of them, we argue, those who feel and have the same kind of perspective and think about these things in a similar way as I do, we maintain that, well, that's not actually racism, that's bigotry, because all the black people in this nation cannot reduce the level of family wealth, for example, average level of family wealth, by our dislike, if you see what I'm saying. When you look at the consequences of a racist system, the amount of wealth that black families hold is so much less than that of white people. That's systemic. It's not about one person making a decision.
Do you feel it is important do you believe that what the teacher was doing was a good was a good attempt. There is a quote in this article in the Washington Post about the importance of teaching tolerance as a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yes.
And one of the writers from that center in some of the literature that they've put out made a comment that said, this work with students does not come easily. The sanctioned curriculum avoids it, and many administrators frown on it, but we need schools that give teachers wide latitude to tailor curricula to students' needs.
And I would suggest to all listeners that you go to the Southern Poverty Law Center website and the teaching tolerance part of that website. I think they actually have separate platforms you can put in teaching tolerance, and you'll get right there to see the kinds of articles and the kinds of materials and classroom activities and films and videos and books that they recommend, all the kinds of things that they do to help classroom teachers, primarily pre-K through 12, not college, but pre-K through 12 teachers, to bring up these very, very difficult subjects, not just about race, but about all forms of discrimination and prejudice. So it is a very difficult thing to do. One of the things that interested me about the article is that this teacher had heard a discussion along these lines at a university, I believe. So he had gone to a university presentation about this. This is often where the topics are discussed with and looked at and studied about in much more intensive and incisive depth. To bring that to a high school classroom was a big challenge, particularly if it was out of context of anything else that they had discussed. Now, I'm going to say something that I hope that there's no explosions here. There is an analysis of racism.
Get ready, kids.
There's an analysis of racism in the United States with which I and many others are very familiar, which is that by the very virtue of the fact that we live in a white supremacist country, anyone who has white skin privilege and benefits from it and was raised with that differential, whether they embraced it or not, is going to have some residual feelings and perspectives that we could define as racist. There are people who are white anti-racist activists who, when they talk about the issue, one of the first things that they will say is that by virtue of my being a white person in a white supremacist country, I, of course, have racism within me. They have gotten to a point in their evolution, their development, that they can say that without feeling internally devastated and crumbled. Most people, when they think about themselves as being racist, their first response is individualized and self-protective, like, that's not me. That's the worst thing you can be. How dare you say that I could possibly be that? But as I said, a more incisive, not to say a more sophisticated way of looking at all these issues is to say, okay, it goes along with the territory. You know, it's just like, I'm trying to think of like a very positive quality, like living in the Mediterranean. Most people in the Mediterranean eat a better diet than we do, you know? And is that a stereotype, or is that just kind of, it goes with the territory and the culture? So the thing is that, as I said, a more like self-examining willingness to take a risk and take risk in having this very difficult ongoing discussion. People who are white who are involved in anti-racist organizing and anti-racist interventions would say, oh yeah, I can accept the fact that as a white person, I benefit from white skin privilege in this country. And because I was raised white in this country, I probably have some attitudes that I don't even know about. That's why you have implicit bias training. And implicit bias training is for people of every group. It's not just for people who are white. Everybody has implicit bias. So even people of color, we grew up in a racist society as well. And the thing is, when you do the implicit bias test, which you can do online, you're looking at photographs and identifying positive, negative, as pictures go by your eyes so fast you can't even really necessarily see each individual picture. The results can be very surprising, even for people of color, because of that thing of implicit bias. But that's my little lecture for today, so I'm done.
Well, talk among yourselves. Let me check in and say, of course, on much of this, you are right, Barbara. I mean, look, let's face it. We know it isn't that long since Lincoln freed the slaves. If you take the number of And then you had the KKK and all of the bias and everything that happened in this country, Jim Crow. But I want to ask you a question. I really do mean this to be something that I want to put to you, just so you can explain it to all of us. And that is, how come we have a black president in the United States?
How come? Is that the question?
If it's such a racist society, why do we have a black president?
I don't even see those things as necessarily being related, because the reason I believe we have a black president of the United States in the early 21st century is because historical actions, historical events got us to a place in the early 21st century that we could see a black candidate, and by we I mean all people in the United States, all Americans, or most Americans, could see a black candidate as being credible. That's why. And how did that happen? There was a civil rights struggle that began before the 1960s, but was at its peak during the 1950s and 1960s, that changed the status of people of African origin in the United States in a fundamental way as far as social perceptions about us. The reason I know this is because it happened to me. My status as an African American in the mid-20th century, I was born in the 1940s, it actually transformed as a result of the civil rights movement. I was looking at an ad in the New Yorker this week, and it's for a mattress, very fancy mattress. And I looked at it and looked at it. I said, is this a white woman in bed with a black man to advertise a mattress? And indeed it was. But I had to look at it over and over. I said, I bet very few people are looking at this ad and realizing that there has been a real shift. So as I said, I believe a shift in attitudes and perceptions. Oprah's great, Beyonce's great, LeBron James is great, etc. So the thing is, we've gotten to a point that in this nation in the early 21st century, a black person could be seen as a credible candidate for president of the United States and was evaluated, we would assume, then on the basis of his capacity, skills, and merit as opposed to his race. At the very same time, the system of institutionalized racism was not changed or addressed.
I have a question for you. Do you think a black man with a more traditional background could be elected president?
In the sense of not being biracial, or not
even that, but he is a Kenyan father. He's not, his background is unusual even for a black person, wouldn't you say? I mean, I'm talking about somebody whose family has been here for generations.
Some people have posited that
it's almost like he comes from outside the paradigm of race,
and his level of cool and capacity to suffer fools gladly is really phenomenal. But the thing is that some people maintain that, and I'm not sure what a typical black person is, because
I've not
met one yet.
Right.
But the thing is, I haven't. But the thing is that some people maintain that if he had had two African-American parents and have been the same age that he is, mm-hmm. that he might not have been able to pull it off. But the thing
because
is,
of his own personality, or because of the way white
what
America
he had experienced
would,
and what he understood about what he was experiencing and how he was treated. Now, Michelle, his wife, has two African-American parents, mm-hmm. and they are total match, as mm-hmm. far as values and intellect and talent, etc. But we have to look at the factors. Would an African-American with two African-American parents born at the same time who went to the same kinds of schools that he went to have been able to pull it off?
Mm-hmm.
I would say yes.
Okay, let me interject for a second, because we only have a few minutes left. But if there is a continuum, and as you suggest, I think you just suggested, we're doing better and better and better, we're getting to a different place. Does, where Joe started us off, does the fact that this teacher brought this to her classroom, is that helpful in terms of, ending racism, bringing us further on that continuum, or is it more likely that it's creating dissonance?
It was absolutely helpful, because that teacher, who was male, I believe, brought it up. It was very helpful. Just in case you want to read more, Waking Up White by Debbie Irving, the book. I've mentioned it many times.
Yes.
Waking Up White by Debbie Irving. And then an article by Peggy McIntosh, which is called Unpacking the White Privilege Knapsack. It's a classic article. It was written in the 1980s. Unpacking the White Privilege Knapsack. So much to discuss.
Go ahead, Alan.
No, you joke. I was just curious.
So the statement that was made by the teacher that we are white and therefore we are racist. Do you agree with we are out of time, but I just want to. I'm curious as to whether is that a correct statement?
Well, the thing is those of us who think about this and act on these issues in a certain way understand that that's a catalytic stepping stone, a statement. That's like a statement that catapults you into another perspective, which is, okay, once I admit that I may have racism, what am I going to do about it?
So let me rephrase the question and say, for having a discussion in a class with students, is that a good opening line?
I think given that it was a high school class and given that I don't know what they've been discussing up until that day, I don't know that people were prepared, his students were prepared for that level of a discussion. I don't know.
Good stuff. All right. Barbara, Alan, Chris, thank you very much. Yeah, I was just going to say Churchill. Sorry.
We'll fight them on the beaches.
Thank you. Alan, rest up. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. Thank you very much. Barbara, have a lovely weekend. Chris,
thank you
do
so
the
much.
Same. Thank you very much. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.